Hello and welcome to Diving Into Diabetes, the podcast where we explore the latest advances in best practices on individualized diabetes care. I'm your host, Dr. Ron Goldenberg, and with me on the program today is Dr. Meera Luthra. Dr. Luthra is an endocrinologist affiliated with St. Joseph's Healthcare and McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario. Today we'll be discussing a very important topic, and that is exploring clinical inertia and intensifying treatments to basal insulin. So welcome, Dr. Luthra. I'm looking forward to an exciting discussion on this topic with you today.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here and likewise to discuss this topic that is very important.
So let's get started. And before we get into a deeper dive and discussion, let's just set the stage of the topic. And so simply, what is clinical inertia in the context of overall diabetes management?
Yeah, so we see this as an issue where many patients have higher sugars than their target, but we're not necessarily advancing their treatment to achieve those targets. As you know, both the ADA and Diabetes Canada suggest that for many people with diabetes, we should be aiming for an A1C less than 7%. We also have CGM metrics now, and yet many patients have A1Cs above this with ongoing treatment plans that don't have the addition of agents like insulin despite the higher sugar. So we feel that this is clinical inertia and intensification that is potentially problematic.
And I'm sure you'll agree we see this in the real world, because all of us get referrals for patients with elevated A1C, and we look back in their file and they've had A1Cs above target, not just for months, but sometimes many, many years. So this is a very important issue in the real world that needs to be addressed. And so what do you think some of the factors are that contribute to this therapeutic or clinical inertia, particularly related to initiating basal insulin in type 2 diabetes?
Yeah, I think there's several factors on both sides. So, you know, from a patient perspective, there's always this sense that initiation of insulin somehow represents a personal failure, that they have failed to meet their targets with all of their efforts, and this is the end of the road. Many patients will provide anecdotes about how their mother turned blind or their family member started dialysis right after they started insulin. And there's these negative associations when in fact it was the uncontrolled sugars for a long time that would have led to that outcome. A lack of understanding or ability to, you know, use injectable treatments can be a barrier. And sometimes patients feel that they'll just become dependent on insulin. And from a healthcare provider perspective, I think it's felt to be a little bit more challenging because they're worried about potential adverse effects, worried about the support that they need to provide to the patient. So lack of time and resources can be a barrier. And I think on both sides, there's this big fear of hypoglycemia and weight gain, which are known adverse effects of insulin treatment. But as you know, we've come a long way in terms of mitigating those adverse effects. It continues to be a problem, though, it seems, on both sides of the equation.
So I guess we have to address both the patient factors and the healthcare provider factors in order to be, first of all, aware of therapeutic inertia and then to counteract it. But, you know, some people say that diabetes is a chronic disease. It takes a long time to develop advanced complications. And so what's the rush? Why should I be so concerned about achieving as near normal glycemia as possible in a timely fashion? So why is it important to address this clinical inertia in a timely fashion?
Absolutely. And you're right. Many people feel that time is on their side. And yet we have lots of data showing that when sugars are running high and we have uncontrolled sugars or even A1Cs that are 1 or 1.5% above target, there is an increased risk of both macro and microvascular complications. So we're not just worried about nerve damage or also eye damage, but also kidney damage. And we know that diabetes is a leading cause of dialysis in North America. Patients have an increased risk of cardiovascular disease, and those with diabetes will get heart disease and heart attacks 10 years earlier than their non-diabetic counterparts. So while it is a chronic disease, early intervention can really help to improve the outcomes and reduce the risk of complications. And we do have good evidence for that. So we're really trying to get out the message that it's important to try to get sugars under control using treatments that are safe and effective as early and soon as possible.
Yeah, for sure. And we have a great toolkit now to optimize glycemia. It keeps improving year after year as newer classes and newer agents have become available. And basal insulin is still an important part of the treatment pathway in type 2 diabetes. So can you just talk about at what stage basal insulin can be considered as part of the therapeutic tools that are available in type 2 diabetes?
It's certainly an exciting time with many agents available in our toolkits, like GLP-1 receptor agonists and SGLT2 inhibitors that have really good data supporting improvement in outcomes for both heart and kidneys. But basal insulin does remain an important part of our toolkit. And as you know, when patients are hospitalized or sick or have other comorbidities, we're not able to safely use some of these agents. We have patients coming in with pancreatitis or heart failure in hospital, and we really rely on using insulin when they're unwell to help control their sugars. Then there's patients treated with steroids where insulin is the most effective in bringing their sugars down, whether that's a part of their rheumatological treatment or cancer treatments. I also find that patients that have long-standing diabetes do end up with diminished pancreatic function and have significant fasting hyperglycemia. For those patients, while the other agents are still very beneficial, adding in basal insulin to start the day off with a good fasting sugar can be very beneficial in lowering their A1C. And we have these patients that, despite taking oral agents and some injectables, still have high A1Cs, as we said, for sometimes months and years. So even their intensification with the addition of insulin can be very helpful. And then having insulins now that have less hypoglycemia and are safer to use is certainly easier for the patients and for the healthcare providers to initiate.
So yeah, there are many scenarios, as you suggested, that an individual with type 2 diabetes might initiate basal insulin. And you alluded to the fact that if you're uncontrolled on a few non-insulin agents, basal insulin still plays a role. So in practice now, probably the most common approach is that GLP-1 receptor agonist in most individuals would be the first injectable. Usually that's in combination with metformin and often an SGLT2 inhibitor. But despite that approach, many people will still need additional therapy to optimize glycemia, which is where basal insulin fits in. And surprisingly, there have been very few randomized trials looking at adding basal insulin on top of GLP-1 therapy. But recently, and importantly, I know there have been two real-world studies that have contributed to our knowledge around adding basal insulin to background GLP-1 receptor agonist therapy. These two studies were the RESTORE-G and the DELIVER-G study. So maybe we'll start with RESTORE-G. Tell us what this study was designed to show and what the top-line results were.
For sure. So the RESTORE-G was a real-world retrospective multi-center study where they looked at patients who were already on GLP-1 receptor agonist therapy and then either added on basal insulin, switched to basal insulin, or switched to a fixed ratio combination of insulin and a GLP-1 receptor agonist. There were some noteworthy results, one of which was that about 40% of patients at the outset were not at target A1C levels. So this was reflecting the clinical inertia that we just spoke about. After switching or adding basal insulin or going to a fixed ratio combination that had both agents, they showed that they were able to have a reduction of A1C of about 1% in the three groups without any episodes of severe hypoglycemia. And they also had a low rate of documented hypoglycemia over a 12-month period. So treatment intensification didn't result in more hypoglycemia, but they were able to show efficacy with a 1% lowering of A1C, which was very encouraging.
So RESTORE-G shows us that, well, GLP-1 receptor agonists have a lot to add for our patients. Many patients still need more glucose lowering. And in the real world, there's many patients who have probably delayed addition of basal insulin, which is kind of upsetting because adding basal insulin worked no matter how you do it in these patients who are already on established GLP-1. So the other study was Deliver-G, and Deliver-G helps kind of build on our knowledge that when we're adding basal insulin in type 2 diabetes on top of GLP-1, many clinicians prefer one of the newer, longer-acting analogs, like a second-generation analog. So can you tell us about the Deliver-G study and its results?
Yeah, so in Deliver-G, they looked at the addition of, as you say, the newer second generation basal insulin, glargine U300 or Toujeo, to patients taking GLP-1 receptor agonists. And this study was done from 2014 to 2020 in adult patients with type 2 diabetes who were all insulin naive, about 300 patients. And to start off, the average A1C was 9% in these patients on GLP-1s. With the addition of U300 glargine, they were able to show again a 1% reduction in A1C. And interestingly, there was actually no significant change in weight in this group where insulin was added. So being on the GLP looks like mitigated some of the weight gain concerns that patients would have. And also, there was no overall difference in incidence of hypoglycemia after adding insulin glargine. So this was very reassuring because they started off with definitely elevated or suboptimal A1C levels. And with the insulin, they didn't gain more weight, didn't have more hypoglycemia, but were able to get down to closer to target to an average A1C of 8%. So that was reassuring.
It's so great. Two newer real-world studies to show the value of adding basal insulin on top of GLP-1s, and hopefully with this knowledge, healthcare providers will counteract this clinical inertia and jump on board earlier rather than later by additional basal insulin. So let's finish up and talk about some of the practical approaches you may use in practice when you need treatment intensification to improve glycemic control, particularly around initiating basal insulin.
So one thing I didn't mention earlier that I should highlight is that if your patient at the outside is already showing features of metabolic decompensation, like excessive weight loss, very high sugars, A1Cs that are well above target, then we do consider insulin upfront in that toolkit, even if they're not sick and in hospital. But even if that's not the case and we're initiating other agents, as you said, Ron, that they would be on metformin and a GLP-1, SGLT2, it's beneficial to start talking about insulin early in their course of disease so that they understand the natural course of type 2 diabetes and that over time we do see some beta cell failure and being prepared that they may end up on basal insulin can sometimes mitigate that concern that it's a last resort or failure on their part. As well, now that they are on injectables, sometimes that fear of injections is not as prominent. Thankfully, the devices that they use for GLP-1s are very similar, and the pen needle tips are very similar to the insulin injectables. So we can certainly show them the device. Many times when I've shown a patient an insulin injection, they've said that the finger poke hurts way more than the needle or the injection itself, which is nice to hear. They sometimes picture these big needles and vials, I think, but that's not the case now with all of our insulin devices. And then reassuring them about the newer insulins and their safety with respect to less hypoglycemia can go a long way. I try to use simple titration guidelines. So with Toujeo, for example, you can suggest going up by 1 unit every day until fasting sugars are below 7. They have these treat to target trials that have shown that to be an effective strategy and certainly can simplify that for both the healthcare provider and the patient. And then finally, I think we have this real advantage, at least where we practice in Ontario, that once a patient starts basal insulin or any insulin, they qualify for coverage for CGM sensors. So the Libre 2 sensors get covered if they're on insulin. And I strongly recommend this as soon as they're initiating insulin so that they can have the peace of mind of having low alerts. They can set that a bit higher at 4.5 if they like, or 5 to say if their sugar is dropping overnight, they would get alerted. So they don't have to worry about that fear of, dying in their sleep or having a low blood sugar overnight, which is sometimes prominent for patients. So that really provides a safety net. And even during the day, we can get a sense of their sugars. And if they're going long periods between meals, they can see that their sugars are stable, or if they're dropping, they can certainly treat in time to prevent the low.
Great. Well, thanks for providing some of those practical tips, because it's one thing to be aware of clinical inertia and the various healthcare provider and patient factors, but it's the practical approaches and tips to counteract that inertia that are really key if we're going to address this problem in practice. So we're nearing the end. And if I had to just summarize our brief discussion, I would say that despite increasing use of GLP-1 receptor agonists over recent years, timely addition of basal insulin remains an important issue in practice. Recent real-world studies have definitely provided more evidence about the efficacy of adding basal insulin on top of GLP-1 receptor agonists and other therapies. And hopefully timely initiation of basal insulin and also appropriate titration of that insulin will help address clinical inertia in practice. So thank you, Dr. Luthra, for joining me today. Thanks to our listeners for joining us for this latest installment of the Diving into Diabetes podcast. We hope you enjoyed our discussion of exploring clinical inertia and intensifying treatments to basal insulin. And please don't forget to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Spotify, and stay tuned for new releases.
Thank you.